We're talking about a new UW clinic catering to patients who have undiagnosed diseases. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The UW Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine opened a new clinic this month with plans to take on dozens of cases each year that primary care physicians and specialists haven't been able to crack, haven't been able to solve with a concrete diagnosis. And millions of Americans suffer from rare diseases. What do you want to know about the role of precision medicine in arriving at a diagnosis? 800-642-1234. Dr. Stephen Mine directs the Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, where he's also a pediatrics professor. Dr. Mine, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So the center has been in existence for about 4 years now. What is the role of this new clinic?
The idea of this clinic is to focus on trying to find answers for people who have rare genetic disorders that have not been diagnosed, despite many efforts by clinicians and specialists, and who have gone through a series of genetic tests without any success. And just to give an idea of how many people we're talking about, we have gotten much better at diagnosing people with genetic disorders so that we can now successfully diagnose about a third of them. Mm-hmm. But that still leaves the majority without a diagnosis after they've seen all the specialists that they can. And these diagnostic journeys can take years. So you can imagine if there's a child who might be 1 or 2 years old, when they first start having symptoms, the parents take them to one doctor after another. They see multiple specialists. They get a misdiagnosis or two. And it's only about 5 or 6 years later that on average, they're going to get a diagnosis. And only a third of them will get that far. And so we're trying to improve that. And at the same time, address one of the major issues as to why the diagnostic rates aren't any better. So an obvious reason is that we don't know all of the diseases or all of the genes that can cause genetic disorders. We think there are several thousand out there that we have yet to discover. So we are expecting that we will discover some new disease genes along the way and as we solve some of these cases.
How will you decide which cases to take up and how you will decide to intervene on these patients' diagnostic journeys?
That's a very good question. We have to pay attention to the resources we have and the bandwidth we have. And so we are focusing on those patients who seem most likely to have a underlying genetic cause for their disease. I'm a geneticist, but I know that not everything that you see in the clinic is genetic. And so we are going to be prioritizing those individuals who we think have a genetic explanation for their clinical problems.
Where will the patients come from?
We are open to patients from all geographic areas. We expect that many of the patients will come from Dane County and Madison, but we have no geographic restrictions. And so we expect that some families will come from elsewhere in Wisconsin, and we may also have families that come from outside Wisconsin, or there may be some family members that are outside Wisconsin.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Mine, who directs the Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, which has opened a clinic for undiagnosed diseases. You can join in. What questions do you have about genetic technology and diagnosing rare or unknown diseases? 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Mine, we've become more accustomed to the terminology of virus variants in the pandemic, and it makes me wonder whether new disease genes are always popping up for you, always popping up and keeping you on your toes. Like, are you discovering new disease genes?
Yes. What happens is this. The rare disease, or the rare genetic disease community has been working on trying to find as many human disease genes as possible. We think there are at least 9,000, maybe 10,000, of which we've discovered a bit over half. So we think there are still several thousand left. And we keep track of how fast we can discover these. And over the last 5-8 years, we've been averaging several hundred a year, new disease genes. And so we figure at this pace, we're going to be at this for a number of years in the future, probably another decade. And we solve these cases and we find these genes by using a multifaceted approach. Some cases are easy to solve, some are difficult. We use some, and sometimes it's one technique that's successful, sometimes it's another. But it's the comprehensive nature of how we approach this that we think will give us the best chance of solving these problems for our patients.
Is there a way to stop the growth of new disease genes? Can you put an end to them?
Right. Well, I'll make a distinction between new disease genes and new disease causing variants in those genes. So it's not the gene itself that's causing the disease. It's a variation in the sequence, the DNA sequence of that gene. We all have thousands of variants in our genes. Fortunately, most of them are harmless, and it's only a few that can cause trouble and cause disease. And so we're after identifying and correctly classifying those variants to be able to find the ones that cause disease. Now, most of the variants that cause disease are actually inherited from your parents. Mm-hmm. But there are some variants that will cause disease that are new with you, the individual, that you have a new mutation, and that is causing the disease that you have. And but that's not the usual story.
I want to step back here for a moment, and you mentioned going on this diagnostic journey that can often start in when a patient is very, very young. What happens when someone is suffering from an undiagnosed condition? What might that experience be like?
It's hard to give a average because there's so much variation, but we have looked at what happens in childhood. And I want you to understand that most rare genetic disorders present when you're a child, but not all of them, about a third of them present in adults. But we'll focus on the two-thirds that present in childhood. Most of those, you first notice symptoms and signs in the first year or two of life. And it's when the parents first notice that there's something unusual about their child that they will go to their doctor or their healthcare provider, and they'll ask them to tell them what's going on and mm-hmm. to figure out whether there's a medical problem here. The problem is that each of these conditions are relatively rare, so it's not uncommon for the first clinician to see the patient to never having seen a patient with that disorder before. Mm-hmm. And so they're working a bit at a disadvantage. And they, as is true for most of medicine, you think of the common things first. So typically people will have a misdiagnosis. They'll attribute the symptoms to something that's more common.
Because you have to do so much ruling out before you can go to the next step.
Child develops other problems, then that may initiate a referral to another specialist. That specialist may order additional tests. And then that, without a resolution, without a good diagnosis, they'll create a referral to another specialist, more tests. And this can go on and on for several years.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Mine, who specializes in undiagnosed diseases, leads the UW Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine, which opened in 2017. Have you or a loved one ever struggled with an unknown disease or sickness? Are you following advancements in genetic technology and how the science can help treat disease? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Stephen Mine here on the Ideas Network. We're learning how precision medicine may be the key to helping solve mysterious illnesses connected to the human genome and transform healthcare. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, there could be as many as 7,000 rare diseases, with an estimated 25 to 30 million Americans living with a rare disease. Are you one? What lengths have you gone to find out more about your condition? Is genetics the future of medicine? 800-642-1234. Dr. Stephen Mine is with us, directs the UW Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine. Dr. Mine, you headed up a program in genetics at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, and now you plan to collaborate more with this hospital. Can you tell us about this type of collaboration?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So when we think about what we're trying to do for our patients, we want to go beyond standard testing, and the most comprehensive testing that people typically get clinically is what's called an exome. It looks at a small part of the genome. The genome is your entire genetic information. So exomes look at about 3% of it, but it's 3% that's heavily enriched for places where changes in the genetic sequence can cause disease. But we want to go beyond that. So we're going beyond it in several different ways, one of which is to try to sequence as much of the genome as possible. And so we have both using standard techniques to do genome sequencing, but also we have something called ultra long read sequencing, which allows us to look at more of the genome and also more of the variations in the genome that cause disease. The other things that we're doing is we're looking not just at the gene sequence, we're looking at how those genes function. And one good way to look at as many genes as possible all at once is to look at what's called the transcriptome. So you hear about the genome, which is all of your genetic sequence. The transcriptome is all of the RNA copies that are made of your genes at any given time. And that can tell us whether a gene is functioning properly. And we could do that here in Wisconsin at UW. We have the machines and the technology for doing it, but my collaborators up in Toronto have been building a database of what is normal for these transcriptomes. And that's key because you have to be able to interpret the data you get. And so it's the fact that they have these extensive normal values. They have sequenced many, many normal individuals of all ages that makes it especially useful for us to collaborate with them so they can give us accurate interpretations, not just accurate data, but accurate interpretations of those data.
You know, along those lines of collaboration, there are human genomics and precision medicine centers at universities all over the country now. And I'm wondering what sets UWs apart?
Right. So different centers for genomics and precision medicine focus on different areas of the fields. And we specifically are trying to do two things. We're trying to both advance the knowledge in human genomics through research, but we are also trying to apply that knowledge in the clinic in various ways. And so this undiagnosed genetic disease program is our first major initiative in that area. And in doing so, we want to be at the cutting edge of how we approach this. So that's why I say we have a number of different novel techniques to do our analyses. So RNA-seq transcriptional analysis is one of those. This ultra-long read sequencing of genomes is another. We also have collaborations to do what's called epigenomic profiling and metabolomics with some of our other collaborators.
So you have all of these different scientific technologies and approaches then that you're able to bring into a clinical setting to really connect with people whose lives have been really disrupted by an undiagnosed disease.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Dana is joining us in Milwaukee. Dana, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I have a question, and I'm not exactly sure it's right down your your alley, but I have my nephew's child who has two very unusual symptoms, and I have been saying, well, maybe you need to get this, talk to a different doctor, because their pediatrician says he's fine. And how do you, like, approach parents? So I've been told not to talk about it anymore. And these two symptoms are, I'll tell you what they are, because I think they're very standout-ish. One is that he looks like a baby. At 3 years old, he looks like an infant, you know, with he doesn't look like a little boy. And the other one is that he's had diarrhea for his entire life. And and the parents won't consider anything, and now he's got all sorts of developmental delays. How do you convince a parent that this, well, first of all, what do you tell them to do, and how do you convince them that this is, might be a very good thing to look into?
Dana, thank you for sharing. Dr. Mine.
Yes, an important question. I would say, first of all, I should tell you a little bit about how patients and families can get to us. We are a referral service. We run the clinical part of the program as a genetics clinic. And so you have to be referred to that clinic by a physician. And then we will evaluate the patients that we see in our clinic, some of which will be eligible for the research side of what we do. And that is where we use all of these new and advanced technologies. Mm. Now, the first step in being referred would be, again, to have a referral from a physician. So in the case of your nephew's child, it's the child's parents that would have to initiate that visit to a physician, to the child's physician, and get them to refer to us. I'm not in a position to give you medical advice about your nephew specifically, but I think that we would be happy to take on referrals that we get from physicians about children and adults who have unusual combinations, and you've described a somewhat unusual combination of clinical problems.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Mine, who directs the Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your questions about the human genome and about undiagnosed diseases, 800-642-1234. Dr. Mine, you know, medical treatments targeting the DNA with new and advanced technologies, there it shows so much promise, but you know, according to Kaiser, insurers often won't cover the skyrocketing cost of precision medicine. Is this cutting-edge medicine affordable?
It's a very important question, and you are right. Insurers tend to be very conservative in terms of covering advances in medical science, and that applies to genomics and that kind of advanced diagnostic techniques we use. Just to give you an example, the exome sequencing, which I described previously as being a standard of care, it wasn't until the last year or so that the major insurers in Wisconsin covered that as a procedure, even though some of our professional societies had recommended adoption of exome sequencing as a standard test more than 5 years ago. So insurers do approach new technologies with some skepticism, but I would say as far as the cost of these tests, it's important to consider the cost to the healthcare system as a whole, not just the test itself. So we have a developing literature that shows that if you use these tests, exome sequencing and genome sequencing, in the proper way, they actually have the economic effect of decreasing overall costs to the system. For example, if you sequence someone early using exome sequencing in their diagnostic journey, you will cut down on what would effectively have been unnecessary further referrals to other specialists and other tests. So we have economic data to show that in the end, using these tests in the right circumstance and using them early enough saves money.
Dr. Mine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to do so.
Dr. Stephen Mine directs the Center for Human Genomics and Precision Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, where he also is a pediatrics professor. Ahead this hour, we talk with the new chair of the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. What questions do you have about police oversight in Milwaukee? What are your top priorities for change? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As businesses reopen across Wisconsin, many workers who lost their jobs due to the pandemic find rejoining the workforce isn't easy. Bram Sable-Smith reports.
Karen Miller wants to work. That's something the 65-year-old wishes more politicians would acknowledge about the 150,000 people like her who lost work in Wisconsin during the pandemic.
We were working. That's what they forget. We were working. We all had jobs. She took them away.
Miller digitized government documents for data dimensions in Janesville before the pandemic shut that work down in March 2020. She's been looking for a new job ever since. A heart condition limits the type of work Miller can do. She'd prefer to work from home, or at least sit at a desk. But when she puts her criteria into work search websites like Indeed.com, she says she gets results for physically demanding warehouse or delivery work, or even nursing jobs she lacks credentials for.
They just throw crap at you to see if it'll stick.
Her search has yielded a few good leads and even some interviews, but it's yet to result in a new job. She suspects her age has something to do with it.
I'm willing to take an entry-level position, but they don't want to train somebody that's 65 years old.
Earlier in the pandemic, Wisconsin lawmakers championed the cause of suddenly jobless workers like Miller, even as Republicans and Democrats blamed each other for an unemployment insurance system that drowned beneath a flood of claims and argued over how to fix it. Miller herself waited 11 weeks for her first unemployment check. That forced her to spend down her life savings and tap into Social Security 5 years before she preferred, permanently reducing her monthly payment from the federal retirement program.
But I need to supplement that. It's not enough to live on.
But as vaccinations allow businesses to reopen, Republican lawmakers have called for an end to federal unemployment supplements that give people like Miller an extra $300 a week. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called the program a disincentive to work that prompts, quote, mischief among the unemployed. Miller has noted the shift in attitude towards the jobless.
They think we're all just sitting around.
But economists are mixed on whether the federal supplements actually disincentivize rejoining the workforce. The Indeed.com hiring lab found job searches initially increase in states that plan to end supplemental benefits, but have quickly returned to normal, or even below average levels. Other research indicates federal stimulus checks and unemployment supplements helped large swaths of Americans stave off hunger, anxiety, and depression. That's if they could get it. In Milwaukee, Pierre Young is struggling to pay his rent while his jobless claim goes through a lengthy appeals process that could take months. The 51-year-old sold his two trucks to make rent, but now he does not have a car to get to job interviews or work sites.
But I gotta have a roof over my head, so I had no choice, you know.
Madison bartender Jamie McPeters is waiting for his unemployment aid to come after his account was used for attempted fraud. He's leaving his industry altogether to pursue a career in graphic design. He says he won't miss restaurant work, especially during the pandemic.
People just didn't care. Like, they never saw us as actual people, or like, we can get sick and die.
And Karen Miller continues her own work search.
At this point, I'd be willing to work for just about, you know, minimum wage even.
With her Social Security, she does not need a high-paying job, she says, just one she can do. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this story comes from a partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Now to Milwaukee's Fire and Police Commission. It has three new appointments, and it marks a new chapter for the long embattled oversight body marred by ethics scandals, by transparency issues, and the handling of the demotion of Afonso Morales from police chief last summer without due process. How do you feel about the commission? Is it capable of holding police accountable and guiding good policy? 800-642-1234. Ed Filone is the new chair of the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. He's an associate professor of law at Marquette University Law School. Ed, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. This commission has had one crisis after the next. What is your plan as the new chair?
Well, I think I've said from the beginning when Mayor Barrett asked me or nominated me for this position, my number one goal is to preserve what we have in the city of Milwaukee, which is the oldest, the most powerful, and the most independent civilian oversight over our police and fire departments. There are people marching in the streets across this country demanding more community oversight of their peace officers. And we have that here in Milwaukee. And so my number one priority going forward is to make sure that we operate efficiently and effectively and transparently so that we can keep this because we need to have community oversight. We need to have a community voice in the policing policies in particular that we live under.
And you mentioned policies. Your commission sets policies and procedures. It dictates the hiring and training process. Final say on discipline and promotions. Is the FPC too powerful?
Too powerful? Oh, hardly. I think that it's appropriate. You know, policing has always been a highly political issue in communities. And even nationally, we see policing policies being politicized for purposes of winning elections. And so it's far too important an issue to leave to politicians who could enact policies simply, you know, to try and win votes or elections. I think citizen oversight, and in particular, a citizen voice. I mean, we are the community, and the seven commissioners represent the community. We're in touch with people in Milwaukee, all parts of the city. We are the ones who are affected by policing. We're affected when the policing is not adequate and crime is impacting our lives. We're affected when police engage in overzealous policing. And so to have a role in setting the policy and the parameters, things like our recent banning of all chokeholds, for example, it's vital that the community have that power.
We're going to talk further about policing itself, but want to get your sense. Last year, last August, nearly a year ago, Police Chief Afonso Morales was demoted. What do you think of that decision?
Well, I really am not at liberty to look backwards. This is a matter that is still in litigation. The final settlement has not been approved by the Common Council. So I won't really comment on open litigation until it's done. But the important thing is we have now a majority of the commission, four of the seven members who are new since that action was taken. We are working together, all seven members, focusing on the future. We will hopefully have a new chief of police for Milwaukee to hire. We'll have to decide how to proceed on that search and who indeed we think should get that position and who agrees with our priorities on policing. And so really we're focused on moving forwards and not looking back.
Yeah, you're focused on the future. I hear that. But, you know, an Inspector General report from February said the FPC went against legal advice provided by the city attorney's office in the demotion of Morales. How do you plan, as you look forward, how do you plan to work with the attorney's office?
Well, one of the things about my background, some of your listeners may remember I ran for office on two occasions. I know many of the people in City Hall personally over the years, a 30-year career professionally, you start to know people. I know the city attorney personally. I know members of the Common Council personally. And what's important, and I just say that to emphasize, what's important when you have an independent body like the Fire and Police Commission that has to work in conjunction with the city of Milwaukee, with the Common Council, the mayor's office. You need to have trust. You need to have trust. And in, I think we have a good relationship across the board, and I think we do have that trust. And I'll also say, when you have a civilian oversight body, these are people, you know, appointed to the commission who are not necessarily, you know, professional public safety officials. They're not necessarily politicians. And so it is crucial that they get strong support from the city of Milwaukee, its staff, its services. And so I look forward to working with the city attorney and making sure that we have very open lines of communication going forward.
I hear you say relationship building here is really key among commissioners and building those relationships in City Hall and elsewhere on the streets of Milwaukee. What are you seeking in the city's next police chief?
Well, I think it's clear number one priority has to be public safety. And then how do you achieve that? And it's extremely important that the Fire and Police Commission and the next police chief, next permanent chief, share the same goals and strategies for protecting the citizens of Milwaukee. And so part of this will be, as a new chair, building consensus with the other commissioners and agreement on what we think the proper strategy should be. And I think there I can say, certainly among the commissioners, we share a view that public safety is not just law enforcement, but it's a holistic issue. It involves intervention with youth. It involves training the police to know what is an appropriate law enforcement situation and what is perhaps not an appropriate law enforcement situation. It involves the community reintegrating individuals after they've completed their prison sentence. So certainly we want a chief who shares our view that policing is not the be-all and end-all of public safety, but merely one part of a holistic approach. And then we want to have an individual that we can work with to implement the goals and strategies. So we should be in agreement on where we're headed, and we should have an individual who has the experience and the talent who's able to implement that vision.
Meanwhile, Milwaukee set a record of 189 homicides last year. Car thefts are up 152%. How will you reckon with those types of numbers as you look for a new police chief?
Well, I think we certainly have some challenges right now in policing. I think it's worth noting that every major urban area in the country is seeing a rise in some aspects of criminal statistics. Some of it is probably related to individuals being at home because of the pandemic, and some of it we should remember is while the rates may be rising, they are not near the historic highs that we've seen in our country. We are bouncing back, unfortunately, somewhat. But, you know, in terms of addressing it, that's really where it's important to have clear goals and strategies, to understand what we expect of our police department and what we don't expect of our police officers, and then make sure that our other community leaders, whether it's the Common Council of Milwaukee or the mayor's office or even community groups, whether they're stepping up and doing their part to help reduce crime in the city, give our young people alternatives to the street and to destructive behavior, and creating an environment where we can all be safe and we can all thrive.
Ed Filone is with us, one of the three newly appointed members to the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission, and will serve as chair of the oversight body. What do you think about police oversight boards? What function should they serve to a community? And what are you watching for out of the commission with new faces on Milwaukee's oversight body? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ed Filone on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the future of Milwaukee's Fire and Police Commission with its new chair, Ed Filone, on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fallone took part in his first commission meeting last week when he was elected chair in a unanimous vote of the commissioners. Do you live in Milwaukee? What actions do you want from the new commissioners on this oversight board? 800-642-1234. Ed Fallone is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Jim is joining us from Hartford. Jim, hi. What are your thoughts?
To me, it sounds, no disrespect to you, Ed, but to me, it sounds like the same old thing. It seems to me you're just going down the same road of failure. You're blaming it on COVID. You're blaming it on, you know, you seem to think that there's other ways to stop crime other than police. I think the fact that you scared all the police officers and a lot of people have resigned, that's your cause for the rise in crime. You have to have a good, strong element in Milwaukee of crime, you know, of law officers to uphold the law. You know, how are you going to uphold the law without police officers? It's just not going to happen. You're just going down the road of failure, I think.
Jim, thanks. Ed?
Thanks for the comment. I think that obviously training and retention of our officers is going to be key to success in the future. Our police do a fantastic job. And the important thing from the perspective of the Fire and Police Commission is that we have the same goals and objectives. There's a variety of policing strategies that have been tried in urban areas. And one thing we have to remember is the impact those strategies have on the community. The police are not separate from the community. They're a part of the community. It's important to recognize that, and their strategies have an impact. And so if the community doesn't believe that policing policies are effective, or if they believe that they have impacts on, for example, improperly having police involved in mental health breakdowns when perhaps mental health officials would be better able to deal with that situation, or improper use of force if the community feels that police interactions too quickly involve the use of force and that force escalates too quickly and inappropriately, then that's something we have to deal with. But it's not a question of the community versus the police. It's a question of the police and the community working together in a shared goal to provide public safety in a manner that the community accepts and welcomes.
Well, let's probe that a little further. You know, we talked last year during your run for the state Supreme Court. We talked about your deep roots in Milwaukee's Latino community. How can police agencies build trust within communities of color that have been historically mistreated?
I think that personally, and I'm not speaking for all 7 members of the commission, but personally, I believe community policing is the way to go. Community policing refers to having close ties between officers and the members of the community they serve. Two of those aspects, having police officers who actually live in the city of Milwaukee, who know the community, and develop relationships with community leaders, with community organizations, so that the police officer is seen as someone who is part of the fabric of the community they patrol, and individuals, business owners, residents feel comfortable. They know the officers, they feel comfortable approaching the officers, telling the officers about issues, concerns they have. I really believe community policing is the way to go. And so I think that that's how you get a partnership, a collaboration between the department and the citizens they serve. Obviously, it's important to have a police chief who would be on that same page. And again, this is simply my personal opinion, and I would expect all the members of the commission to first reach a consensus on exactly what strategies and objectives we have for a new chief as part of our search when that happens.
You mentioned officers living in Milwaukee, knowing their community. Would you support residency requirements for city police officers?
Well, what we have is a series of incentives to encourage officers to live in the city. We have, unfortunately, some judicial decisions over the years that limit the ability of police departments to require residency, but we can still create incentives. And I think we have to continue to look at that. I think the ideal would be to have a police force that mirrors the citizens that they serve. I think that would be the ideal. So any way we can move in that direction, certainly that's something I support.
We're talking with Ed Filone, the new chair of the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. You can join in, still time. How do you feel about Milwaukee's Police Oversight Board? Is the board effective at holding police accountable and guiding good policy? 800-642-1234. Ed, have you seen meaningful changes in Milwaukee since the protests against George Floyd's murder last year?
I think I have. I mean, I think the city is fairly united. For those of your listeners who live outside of Milwaukee, I think the city is fairly united in recognizing that there is a history in Milwaukee, in the police department, that at different times we've had different policing strategies that have focused more on, in the past was sometimes called the broken windows strategy of just focusing on enforcement of even minor legal violations and the idea that that would deter more serious crime. And I think that there is a recognition in the city of Milwaukee that those increased interactions lead to more opportunities for things to go wrong, sometimes rising out of a traffic stop or vagrancy issue. And all of a sudden you have a use of force situation and potential injury either to the officer or the citizen. So I think there's a recognition that we need to avoid that sort of policing, and the community doesn't want it. At the same time, the community, people who live in Milwaukee want to be safe. They want to be able to have their kids play in their front yard or ride their bikes in the street. And so clearly we're not talking about, zeroing out the police budget by any means. We're talking about having a clear strategy that uses the police to their best effect and that works in conjunction with other groups who are perhaps better able to deal with some of the other social issues that we have here in the city. That's my perspective.
Very quickly here, as we're out of time, the new ban against police chokeholds, except in life or death situations or self-defense, do you support allowing chokeholds in some situations?
Personally, I would just say that the anecdotal questions I've heard, discussions I've had with police officers, people I respect in the profession indicate they never see any need to use a chokehold. There are so many alternative ways to interact with a citizen. And so if the officers say they don't see a need for a chokehold, then certainly I would see personally nothing wrong with a complete ban. But we have the policy we just put in place, I believe, this last May. And we'll see how it works going forward. That's what the commission does. Oversees policies. Are they working? And makes changes where needed.
Ed Filone, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ed Filone is the new chair of the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. He was nominated to the commission by Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.